This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith.
Providing a stable foundation for children through parenting. Our guest is Dr. Jodi Ann Mullen, a licensed mental health counselor and play therapist and professor of counseling and psychological services at SUNY Oswego. Her book, Raising Freakishly Well-Behaved Kids, focuses on what parents can do and, more importantly, according to Mullen, how they can be. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Mullen.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So today's show is on the theme of growing up. Mm-hmm. And the people who influence a person's growing up process the most are parents. So it makes sense to start there. Jodi, the subtitle for your book is 20 Principles for Becoming the Parent Your Child Needs, which I think is interesting because this just isn't about getting your kids to behave a certain way, but it's about providing what your kids need. So can you explain the importance of that to us and the link between the two?
Yeah, sure. A lot of times we forget that children's behavior is actually communication. And so when children are behaving in any particular way, they're really communicating something to us. And so as parents, if we have a way to read that communication, understand that communication, there are lessons that our children are teaching us about what they need. And just so many of us kind of disregard those lessons because we don't know how to understand them. And so the 20 principles are really based on what are the lessons that I've learned from my own children and the children that I've worked with in 25 years of being a mental health counselor.
So what is that link between giving them what they need and good behavior?
So when they get what they need, then they don't have to act out. So if you think about it this way, acting out very much is a communication. And if we are meeting their needs, if we're understanding them and they feel understood and loved and respected, then they don't have to act out and they can show you that other side of themselves, that pro-social side of self that wants to cooperate and wants to be connected.
So your first two principles are love and respect. Mm-hmm. So how important that is to that growing up process?
It has to be there throughout. I think that sometimes we just struggle as parents, and definitely myself as well. So I want to be honest about that, that I have never done any of this perfectly. And so that's part of how I learn the lessons. But love and respect are challenging at different ages. So for instance, the myth of the terrible twos is when your child really starts to assert themselves. They can say no all of a sudden and they don't want to do certain things. They make it more challenging. If we don't respect that value of them saying no, then we're going to miss out from two and again at five and again in their teenage years. So if we can learn to respect that they don't want to do something and just honor that, then as they progress through development, we can maintain that respect for them. And that is paramount to having a good relationship with your child.
Well, and it's hard to remember to respect that that's part of their growing up process when you just really want them to stop behaving a certain way in public,
yes,
for example.
Absolutely. And so our default is like, stop doing that or you'll listen to what I say. But if we just circumvent it with honoring that we get that they don't want to put their shoes on right now, for instance, and then say, it's not a choice, or and then say, but you have to have shoes on if you want to go visit grandma. It's the part that we do first, honor that they don't want to, acknowledge if they're tantruming, for instance, about that, that that's a way they're communicating to us they don't want to. And so if we just honor and acknowledge that with love and respect, then they can move on. But if we get in a power struggle with them there, we ruin that moment, that opportunity.
The other thing that interested me about your book is that it's really about principles, mm-hmm, and values. It's not a how-to guide,
no,
like, you know, timeout should be 10 minutes.
Right.
Why do you believe it's more important to understand the values and the why behind the way we parent?
We all parent in different ways. We have different styles. Some of us are more quiet. Some of us are more outgoing. And the same is true of our children and also what our larger family values are. So when I was coming up with this, I was looking at things that we can do as parents regardless of how old our child is, regardless of what our faith is, regardless of how much we think you should express physical affection and that kind of thing. And so the principles allow parents the flexibility to take that and make it work for their family, make it work for them. And I think that that flexibility is needed. When we look at typical parenting books, they say, do it this way. And sometimes that just doesn't make sense for your family. I often use this example, and I know I do in the book, about I have a very strong-willed daughter. There's some things that just wouldn't work for her in terms of technique, but in principle, they would.
And I think knowing the principle behind something is about knowing your goal versus it takes 10 seconds to do this or try this three times or something like that.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Yeah, is knowing what is it that you're hoping the result of this to be.
Now, you mentioned the principles all come from listening to children, your own and the ones that you've treated. And you mentioned that children teach us what they need from us as parents. But how does that work exactly? I mean, principle number five is listen to me. But if children can't verbalize, how does this work?
So first of all, we have to throw out the whole idea that they're going to communicate to us verbally, especially when they're younger. And so this has as much to do with child development as it does with my expertise as a play therapist. All of us know this. If you've ever spent any time around a child, that play is one of the ways that they communicate, right? And so if we think about their communication as being nonverbal, what is in their facial expressions, their body language, their play, their, we call it paraverbals, the sighs or the, you know, things like that, the noises that they make, those are all communications. And so when children are saying, listen to me, they're not necessarily saying, listen to my words. Although we as parents, it's been kind of trending for the last 15, 20 years where we say, use your words, use your words. But we're forcing them then to speak or communicate at a level that we speak at as adults. Verbally, where if we made effort and really listened to their nonverbals and their play, then we would be able to listen to them in a bigger way, in a more fulfilling way, in a more accurate way.
So look for those cues of frustration or excitement or that kind of thing.
Yeah. And as parents, we're really well situated to know that. Like I can tell when my daughter's now 19, but even when she was little, I could tell when she was lying and nobody else could do it. And part of it was this kind of subtle thing she used to do, putting her tongue in her cheek, right? So I could tell that. I can tell when my son, who's now 15, and I still can tell these things about my children. I can tell when he was upset or something was bothering him, even though he wouldn't say anything. Parents can do that. And I think we sometimes just shortchange ourselves by looking for the words, you know. And one other thing about that is sometimes children don't have the words. And we know that as adults because sometimes we don't have the words to describe something.
Well, I was going to say, even when kids get a little older and more verbal, they don't have the words to describe feelings.
Correct.
You know, even adults don't have the words to describe their feelings sometimes. So I think those cues continue even as they get older, right?
Yes, 100%. And so that's one of the things that we really want to be able to do for our children is to be able to give them the feeling words. Is say, for instance, if they have like a long look on their face, to say like, I can see you're feeling sad about that. Because now they have the word. It's the word is sad. And they can go and use that in another opportunity. That's how all language is learned. And so if we just factor that into what we're doing in our normal day-to-day experiences with our children, we help them to get to that optimal place of growth in that way as well.
Now, the title of your book is about raising well-behaved kids, but you also mentioned well-behaved, thoughtful, and social conscious children. What do you mean by social conscious?
So I think when you use these principles to guide the way that you're parenting, you're doing things like showing respect, showing love, listening, helping your children develop empathy. All of those things or those ways of being are ways that they can then be outside in the world, right? And so with their peers, with their teachers, that they start to recognize those things. You really do pass those down. So I noticed very early on in my children's lives that they were able to pick up on things because we were picking them up with our children. So that happened pretty regularly. I also think when you show respect to a child, then they can show respect, one, back to you as an adult, but also to other people. They learn what that feels like. And it's also, to a degree, I think, a way of just thinking about how the world works, is that if children have an opportunity to behave, if they have an opportunity to act socially consciously, that they'll take that opportunity. I think part of our role as adults in the lives of children is to provide them with those opportunities.
So you describe that consistency and stability are important to children, but what kind of things need to be consistent and what don't?
That's a great question because, again, that is part of why it's a principle is that that's going to look very different in different families, right? And so for some of us, consistency and stability doesn't mean that we every night we have dinner at 5 o'clock, but it means once a week we have dinner together because that's the best we can do. But your kid can count on that. And you want to make sure that you have things that your kids can count on, that they know are always going to be consistent and stable. A lot of times you'll hear parents say to teenagers something like, no matter what you do, if you tell me the truth, you will not get in trouble, right? So that works with your teenager if you've done it all along, right, throughout their development. And so those are things that can even be consistent, not necessarily like having dinner at the same time or every Sunday is, we all go to church together. It doesn't necessarily have to be behavioral or action aspects of consistency and stability, but just who you are as a parent has to have that piece of it.
Now, two principles are tell me no, that kids want to be told no, but kids also want to be told let me try.
Yes.
So those two seem a little contradictory, but tell me why they're not.
I think the timing on tell me no is actually really important where we are culturally in this moment. If you think about the scandals of the parents paying for their kids to get into colleges that they wouldn't have gotten accepted to, I think about that principle a lot with that situation because the idea of telling your child no is so important because they will be told no, right? So first of all, the world will tell them no in lots of different ways. And so they need to be prepared for that, but also what comes with that, what comes with being told no. It sets parameters and boundaries for them in emotional ways and physical ways and psychological ways, all of these different ways that then prepare them for handling situations that will develop. The part of let me try, and I could see why that would seem like those don't quite gel together. The let me try is you have to give them enough opportunity to let them try new things so that they develop new skills, so that they know what it's like to be frustrated. I think where we often make mistakes in the let me try part of parenting is that we're trying to protect our children. I think most of the things that we do as parents come from a place of compassion and wanting the best for our children. Sometimes it just doesn't turn out that way. But the let me try, oftentimes we're getting in our own way because we don't want our child to fail. We don't want our child to maybe get hurt. We don't want our child to be stuck frustrated. So we get in the way of that. And when we get in the way of that, we also get in the way of opportunity on the other side. So if they're really frustrated because they can't get the cap off a marker, for instance, if we rush in like we typically do and do that for them, they might not stay in that state of frustration, but they don't get to feel what's on the other side of that, which is pride and competency. And so we have to, as parents, make judgments about when is the right time to let them try and when is it a hard no. And I think our kids really respond to that. Both the let me tries, it's like, all right, sometimes I'll even say to my kid, it's making me nervous, but I will let you try because I know this is important to you. But safety reasons, of course, are going to be, factor in there. The no's are really important because it helps them, I would say, sometimes even feel more secure. And I know that might sound a little backwards, but sometimes our kids need us to tell them no to protect them emotionally and psychologically, too.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today on Take Care.
Thank you so much. This was a delight.